Welcome to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
So I looked through this list many times and passed this title, Killer Diller, and one day I thought, well, that wouldn't be a bad title. Let's see what the lyrics are. So I turned to the lyrics, and the lyrics were, he's an ugly little, the chorus was, he's an ugly little something from the South. He's a terrible little something. Hush your mouth. He's an awful little creature. He's a killer diller from the South. And I thought, well, there are characters here in the book that that description would fit. And so I decided to use that song.
Don't bother nobody. Nobody bothers me. Boom, boom, boom. I don't bother nobody. Nobody bothers me.
Killer Diller, a reading, conversation, and a musical interlude featuring novelist Clyde Edgerton this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Clyde Edgerton is the author of four novels, including Rainy, Walking Across Egypt, and The Floatplane Notebooks. His most recent book is Killer Diller, published earlier this year by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Set in contemporary North Carolina, Killer Diller includes the stories of sometimes delinquent Wesley Benfield, Wesley's overweight fundamentalist girlfriend Phoebe, and Vernon, the disadvantaged youngster whom Wesley befriends. Killer Diller is filled with religion, music, sex, introspection, and deadpan social analysis. I asked Clyde Edgerton to read from Killer Diller.
Okay, this is a scene in which Wesley, 24, in a halfway house, is teaching Vernon, 16, in a special education class at Hanson High School, how to make vegetable soup. All right, says Wesley. I'll let you do the whole thing from start to finish. First, you got to open these cans. On the counter beside the sink at Vernon's house are a can of soup, cans of tomatoes, of corn, of butter beans, four small red potatoes, two onions, one wrapped beef bouillon cube, a large cooking pot, and a half head of cabbage.
I can open cans.
Vernon gets a bottle opener from the drawer and starts putting triangular holes around the top of a can of vegetable soup. Campbell's. No. Here, give me that. Here. Wesley looks in the drawer, finds a can opener. You gotta use one of these kind. Ain't you ever opened a can?
Hundreds.
I mean the right way.
I got everything I'd ever want to ever open. Why ain't that right?
I mean, look, here's all you do.
My way's just as easy.
No, it's not.
I'll race you.
No. If you do it that way, you get all them little pieces of metal in there. This is what this is, a can opener. What you got's a bottle opener.
Looks like if you open a can with it, it's a can opener too. Something that opens a can opener, it looks like to me. All you have to do,
listen, you can run over it with a car and open it. That don't make a car a damn can opener. Vernon pauses, looks at Wesley.
It would for just a second.
Clyde Edgerton, you've got some wonderful characters in this book, Killer Diller. Let's talk about some of these characters and places.
Okay.
Wesley Benfield is now 24 years old. He's not living any longer with Maddie Rigsby. What happened in those intervening years? What we got, about 6-7 years? Is that germane to this book?
Right. I think Wesley started to attend church regularly.
He's become a Christian.
Yes, he has joined the church, and he calls himself a Christian.
Uh-huh.
but during those 5 years that he was he's been attending church, he made the mistake of taking a white Continental for a ride.
Somebody left the keys in
that
Continental.
Yes.
He just couldn't resist it.
And for some reason, it was important to me that it had a tan interior. I don't know why. And he ended up having to serve some time in a halfway house, the Boda House, back on track again. So he's there, and he's also attending church.
Uh-huh. Clyde, tell me about Phoebe and Maddie, these two female women, strong women characters mm-hmm. in this book of yours, Killer Diller.
Phoebe was more difficult to write about because of the fact that Maddie was established in my mind from another book. I had spent a book on her as a main character, so it was easy for her to become a secondary character. She was ready to talk, and I could see her.
Uh-huh.
It was, and moving from your question a bit, it was difficult to make Wesley, who was a secondary character, a major character. For complicated reasons, but I was surprised that it was difficult. I thought he'd be easy to be a main character, but it was more difficult than I anticipated.
Well, he has such an affection for Phoebe that helped draw him into the orbit, did it not?
That was helpful for him to want Phoebe. Phoebe was difficult. She and I had to work to get her a little more believable. She was plain, and she was there in many ways from the structure of the book for Wesley, to find out about Wesley. So once she was used in that way to help me develop Wesley, I realized that I had to do more with her.
Uh-huh.
So I worked on her some more, but I had to imagine how it is to be overweight or more overweight than I am, and have that as a serious psychological problem.
Well, now what are we to make of her? I mean, here she is, an overweight, would you call her a fundamentalist Christian? She's very Christian.
I think she's a little more tolerant, given that she dates Wesley.
Yeah, and she's working on her own sexuality. She's working on her own ability to sort of be a woman, be erotic, be human.
Right.
Yet she has a lot of reservations about that.
Right. She's attached to her father and listens carefully to what he has to say, and he's concerned about who she's seeing.
Uh-huh.
And why should she be seeing Wesley when there are all these young ROTC cadets she could be dating?
Right.
So imagining her problems was not always easy, and coming up with a way for her to talk, she's from Michigan, and how she might structure her, how she would talk, what she would say. And I had some help on her from my editor, Shannon Ravenel.
Uh-huh.
She reminded me early on that Phoebe needed to be brought out a little bit more and made into a more interesting...
Where are Phoebe and Wesley headed, Clyde Edgerton?
Ooh.
Do they have another life after Killer Diller?
I think so. I think probably I'll find out about that if I do start, and if I can possibly complete a book about where they go and what they do. They're gone from North Carolina, probably. I'm not sure. But... I would guess that they get married, and I'd like to write about that, and then that they have some ups and downs, and Wesley has to decide what his profession is, and then we have all these other people.
You're going to make him a preacher?
At one time, I had was planning to do that in this book, but then I decided against it.
Leave him a musician.
For complicated reasons. If a character who is incomplete in my mind, but I'm starting to develop a character, is interesting to me, I will continue developing that character. By that I mean I'll keep writing about that person in a story and in scenes. It's important to me that characters not be good or bad, the white hats and the black hats, because this simplifies and makes and is distracting and makes the work of fiction very much unlike real life.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have I tell myself that if I have a character who is, quote, a bad person, I want to give that person all the credit that I can, so that person will seem real. And I try to avoid thinking about messages and try to think about what happened in the story and making that visually clear to a reader. And if I can do that and trust that what strikes me and is interesting to me in a scene will be interesting to someone else, then I'm mm-hmm. all set.
We have a string of wonderful scenes, but what happens to the plot? I mean, when you begin the book, did you know how it would end? Does the book play itself out for you as you're writing it? Is that part of the adventure?
What happens for me with most of the books I've written is that I'm not sure where I'm going as I write. I'm not sure I might be sure where a scene is going, but I'm not sure what that means for the book.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like Wesley. That's the way he's living his life.
Right. He does. Sometimes I have the book I'm working on now happens to have an ending. I wrote a short story which I saw as the ending to the book, so I'm writing toward that ending. And occasionally I'll have a scene in mind that will occur later in time from the time I'm working on, and I will write toward that scene, knowing that scene will happen. But I didn't know what the ending of Killer Diller would be until I reached the ending, or near the ending. I had certain ideas, but it's as if driving in a fog, and something emerges from the fog, and you see it, and you decide you can use it, or it works, and so you use it, or it will not work, so you pass it. What happens, much of the plot happens after the first, second, third draft, when I begin to see what the story is about, or begin to see what has struck me in the story and I've written scenes about. The book, the pages have been finished, but then I go in and insert and withdraw and insert to certain scenes or find characters who seem now not to have the meaning that I thought they might, and I take those characters out. And began to polish and have something which is called a plot that that I hope works. This is the most plotted book from my point of view that I've written, because near the end I realized if I changed the other books, I could have changed up to the very end. I could have changed a good bit of the book. This book I realized was holding together, and I could pull out a scene and the whole book would collapse, perhaps. So there was a tender plot, I suppose. By tender I mean I had to be careful about what I did with that plot, and there were also some little suspense detective mystery kind of setups I had to do.
Sure, we wonder what's going to happen with Wesley and with Phoebe. We've got this erotic or sexual line that develops in Killer Diller, and I had the sense that you were sort of baiting us here. You know, well, is Wesley going to succeed or fail with Phoebe, and under what circumstances? Have I got this right?
Well, what was interesting to me, and I think you do, for you know, that raises a point. When you ask if you have it right, I think you do have it right, because you've brought to the book your experience, observation, and your own imagination. And with Wesley, what was interesting to me was this were two callings, two opposing callings. His sexual urges, that was a calling which he felt. And there was also the calling, as he saw it, of his responsibility as a Baptist, how he needed to be handling sexually. He had a calling from the Baptist Church about how to behave sexually.
Right.
He had another calling about how to behave sexually, and he wasn't clear about those two callings, and he decided to go to the Bible for guidance.
What happens to Wesley?
Well, what happened to me and Wesley, as I was writing the book, I realized even though I was raised as a Southern Baptist, I had never read the Bible from the front to the end, straight through, as I do other books.
And Wesley does this.
Wesley does. And for Wesley to do that, I had to do it as the author of the book. And so as I read it, I had my own responses, and I was also imagining Wesley's responses, and occasionally those responses overlapped.
Yeah, he goes to Maddie and he says, are you aware of all this sex that's in this book? He loves the Song of Solomon, for instance.
Right. And one of the most powerful beliefs among Baptists is the priesthood of the believer. So Wesley, as a believer, was able to hit this material and respond to it without any intervention.
Well, it shapes his life. There's no question about that. Speaking of the Gospels, tell me about the Sears twins. Let's come to them. You got a lot of deadpan social analysis in this book, Killer Diller. And here you have these two twin leaders of Ballard University. You make them, well, they're not fools exactly. They're efficient in their own way, and yet they're foolish. Tell me about these characters. You got a grudge against modern religion and universities?
What I have a grudge against, I can use an example of something I read yesterday, which may help understand what I think I have a grudge against. There's a little Baptist paper down in Louisiana There was an article about the parliamentarian of the Southern Baptist Convention. What the article said, and the article was written by a Southern Baptist either editor or minister, what the article said was that it told about how efficient this parliamentarian was. Then it pointed out that he was not a Southern Baptist and therefore should be relieved of his duties.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was that simple and straightforward.
Well, what offended you about that?
What offended me about that is the same thing, and I'm trying to answer the question, but I'll use another example. If and this person also belonged to another church. This person was not an atheist I can't remember the denomination, but it was wasn't Catholic.
Another tribe, that's what you're getting at.
Another tribe. But if a plumber comes to my house,
yeah,
to fix the pipes, if I were a plumber and I went to someone's house and I'd spent years learning to fix pipes, and the owner of the house said, you know, you've been here every year for 12 years, and you've done a wonderful job, but I need to ask you a question.
Are you this or that?
Are you a Southern Baptist?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say no, and the person would say, I'm sorry, that excludes you from doing what you love to do in this particular case because of that. It's just a clear instance in my mind and my view of the worst of fundamentalism.
Clyde Edgerton, your book is Killer Diller. As I was saying, there's a lot of religion, there's a lot of sex, there's a lot of introspection and some social satire in this book. It's also got some wonderful music. I say wonderful, and I'm asking you to help me with what kind of music goes on here. We have very personal lyrics, and we have church lyrics. You're a musician. How did you bring that element to the writing of this book?
Well, I've always, not always, but since soon after high school, I've enjoyed and loved blues music. In high school, it was Dixieland music. I used to spend afternoons listening to Dixieland albums. And my interest moved toward blues, and I suppose you would say conservative jazz. So I've always been interested in playing blues and played some blues on keyboard. Uh-huh. And I wanted the main character to have a passion for music.
Oh, he does. And Wesley's got a long neck guitar?
Right. It's a dobro, bottleneck.
Bottleneck.
He plays it with a bottle on his finger. Bottleneck on his finger, which is a way many blues musicians still play, and especially used to play.
Uh-huh.
And so I wanted, and I'm very attuned to and very much enjoy hearing bottleneck blues. So to me, I wanted him to be interested in that instrument.
Is this one of Wesley's callings?
I think it is. I think he has a little control over that. He's passionate about that music, and that's one reason he was interesting to me as a character. What happened when I was looking for a title, so I knew blues music had to be part of him and therefore part of the book, and I had a big book of blues lyrics, and the table of contents was the list of all these old blues songs, and when I was trying to decide on a title, the working title was The Bottleneck Blues, A History of Religious Bondage in America.
This was your working title.
This was the working title, right? Uh-huh. But I decided to use another title. So I thought it would be nice if I could find the title of a blues song I could use and work into the book. So I looked through this list many times and passed this title, Killer Diller, and one day I thought, well, that wouldn't be a bad title. Let's see what the lyrics are. So I turned to the lyrics, and the lyrics were, he's an ugly little something from the South. He's a terrible little something. Hush your mouth. He's an awful little creature. He's a killer diller from the South. And I thought, well, there are characters here in the book that description would fit. And so I decided to use that song.
Now, you put those words into the mouth of Vernon, who is this special education student. Is there a reason for doing that?
No, I didn't. As I recall, I can't remember who sang the song or how it was, but I thought about both Wesley. In fact, when about the time I titled the book, Vernon was not in it, I believe. Huh. Only Wesley was in it. As I recall, Vernon was the last character to get in this book, which is another story. But Killer Diller, that I went to all the record stores looking for the record. No one had it or had any record of it. So I was talking to someone in Louisiana from Tulane, and they said our jazz archives might have it. We'll get in touch with the guy. And a few weeks later, I get a tape which is the only recording that I know of, 1946 by Memphis Minnie of Killer Diller. And I said, well,
there
I love
is.
The lyrics, but I'm sure I won't like the song. Mm-hmm. So I went next door to the Regulated Bookstore and put it on, and it's a great song. So it sounded, I really liked the sound of it. So it turned out that several other guys and I got together and recorded it in a studio for publicity to send the tape out, and then a few other songs, including some that I let Wesley write.
I want you to give me a couple of riffs here of music from Killer Diller. One passage that we picked out is a little, what do you call this? Just a little mini ballad that Wesley has written about Ballard University?
Yes, I think Wesley thought back to his days as a student and wanted to write a little blues song, so he came up with a song. I believe he's working on the song in the book. I think he never quite finishes, but I'll do a couple of verses of it.
Fire away.
With vocal backup. Boom, boom, do 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 boom. When I sleep in class, I drool all down my desk. When I sleep in class, I drool all down my desk. I like to sleep in math. I like to sleep in English best. Don't bother nobody. Nobody bothers me. Ding, 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 boom, boom, boom. I don't bother nobody. Nobody bothers me. Ding, 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 ding. I've been a graduating senior. Ding, ding, since 1983. Ding, 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 ding.
Clyde Edgerton, is this a comment on Wesley Benfield, your character in Killer Diller, or are you talking about American education?
I hadn't thought about American education. I thought about the once or twice I went to sleep in class and walked out with a large wet spot on my shirt front.
Let's conclude our conversation, Clyde Edgerton. What's the best part of writing for you? What's the reward to it? Is it tough work, or do you really enjoy it?
Night before last, I woke up probably five times and looked at the clock, hoping and wishing that it would be at least 6 o'clock so I could get up and start working on this book I'm working on.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't happen every night, but I always look forward on this book because I've gotten into a book that holds me. I always look forward to getting to it. And when I'm so excited about it that I wake up through the night, if anyone is that excited about anything, that's probably a good part of it. So I must be getting something out of being with these characters alone, writing about what happens to them.
Uh-huh.
And that is, it's strong enough to have that, to cause that kind of anticipation with me. It's not a painful experience usually.
That's good to hear. Clyde Edgerton, I congratulate you on Killer Diller. Thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center.
It's good to be here. I enjoyed it, as usual.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest was Clyde Edgerton, whose novels include Rainy, Walking Across Egypt, and The Floatplane Notebooks. Clyde Edgerton's latest book is Killer Diller, available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. With music from Killer Diller, here are Dusty and the Tail Draggers, also known as Clyde Edgerton and Friends.
He walks up to the stove where I was at. In his face there was a crying cat, cause he's an ugly little something on a scout. He's a terrible little something, hush your mouth. He's an awful little thing, he's a Killer Diller from the South. He walked down the street, looked in the window case. Statue walked out, said, you can take my place, cause he's a ugly little something on a scout. He's a terrible little something, hush your mouth. He's an awful little creature, it's a killer diller from the south. In the hotel, everybody left. He looked in the glass and smiled at himself. Said, I'm a ugly little something on the scout. Why, I'm a terrible little creature, hush your mouth. I'm an awful little thing, I'm a killer diller from the south.
Dusty and the Tail Draggers, with music from Clyde Edgerton's latest novel, Killer Diller. Soundings on the fiction of Clyde Edgerton is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 580. That's program number 580. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, discussions about sociobiology and the psychological foundations of ethics. Wayne Pond will talk with two philosophers, Patricia Greenspan of the University of Maryland and Michael Roos of the University of Guelph.
We use guilt to motivate moral behavior. It's not the only emotion we appeal to, but it's a standard one.
One of the biggies.
Yeah, right. There are other cultures, and I think really most cultures historically too, that use shame in pretty much the same role. That is,
What I'd want to say is that humans, like most other organisms, are a balance. At one level, of course, we're aggressive or we've got aggression. Mm-hmm. And probably there were good biological reasons for this. In fact, it's thought that as we evolved in small groups of humans. And one of the things that there was strong biological pressure to do or to be was very wary of other groups of humans. That, in other words, it wasn't saber-toothed tigers who were our big threat, but fellow human beings across the other side of the hill.
Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Killer Diller, a reading conversation and music featuring novelist Clyde Edgerton, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Clyde Edgerton's novels include Rainy and Walking Across Egypt. This week on Soundings, Edgerton talks about his latest book, Killer Diller, a fable of the modern South that's filled with religion, sex, music, introspection, and deadpan social analysis. Killer Diller, the latest from novelist Clyde Edgerton, this week on Soundings.